right? A mosque is a place where people gather for religious services and so forth. Mm-hmm. Yes.
There was a thing recently in Holland that a bishop, I think a Catholic bishop, was basically saying they should start calling, Christians should just start calling God Allah, just so there wouldn't be, need to cut down tensions with the Muslims. And of course, that got a big brouhaha. But that's basically the same thing. I mean, people know the way Christians go around doing that, and yet they're willing to do it.
Well, actually, I've heard people present on both sides of this. Some people think it is worse. Some people think it's not a problem at all. I really can't comment, not knowing Arabic, but it might be similar. It might be similar. But with regard to ecclesia and our English word mosque, it certainly is similar to what you're describing in the way you understand Allah, certainly. So what's the difference for mosque? Why can't we just use mosque for ecclesia?
It has a connotation.
And a denotation, too.
Yeah.
And an etymology.
Uh-huh.
In other words, the problem with it is that words have meaning. Mm-hmm. When people say you're just arguing over words, a lot of times they're forgetting that words have meanings. And by the way, when it isn't important if you substitute one word for another, no one gets upset. Mm-hmm. Have you ever noticed that people say it's only a question of words and are upset about it? If it's only a question of words, why are they upset about it? That in itself shows you that it's not only a question of words. If it were only a question of words, they wouldn't be upset. So the problem is that words actually have meaning, and they convey that meaning to people. Now, sometimes people understand different connotations by different things, of course. We talked about this with regard to Christ. It means it connotes something very different to a typical Jewish person and a typical Gentile person. The same thing would be true of church. It connotes something very positive to a typical Christian and something very negative to a typical Jew. So sometimes the same word can be understood differently by different people. But in either case, words actually have meaning. And that's why it makes a difference which words you use. And of course, if we want to relate this to the scripture, I think God gives a few warnings and messages about choosing our words carefully. Mm-hmm. And that we will give account for every idle word, every single word that we utter. Which is something pretty heavy to think about.
Goodness, all women are in trouble.
Because we need all these extra words, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, in answer to the question, maybe church is the wrong word, but it's still something. If you just use the word church in the English Bibles and the Tanakh, you know, and just came up with however many times that was used, then it would, I mean, you could say, well, the word means the same in either case, so let's use it everywhere. But then you'd get something that looks a lot different. It would certainly show that the distinction they're trying to make, that what's in the Messianic scriptures is new, is not new.
Right. Right. Well, again, I'm not making theological statements about whether it's new or not. And I mean, of course, the Bible does talk about a new covenant, again, something that is in what people consider to be the old covenant. It's in Tanakh. I'm only making comments about the linguistic newness. Linguistically, it's not new. So if you want to understand the meaning of the word, you can't understand a new meaning of the word. That doesn't mean there might not be something new that's being described by those words, but you can't understand something new by the word itself. That's the main point. Now, the first part of what you were saying is, I think, a good point as well. If the translators had chosen to use the word church in Tanakh for Kahal and in Ephesus for the mob, then church might have a different meaning in English now. Of course, they didn't do that, though. So church had its own particular meaning that did not correspond to the biblical meaning and does not today correspond to the biblical meaning. So if we want to know the biblical meaning, we have to try to discover the biblical meaning.
So when you are talking with people who are coming from a church background, I mean, do you not use the word church at all? Or do you use it because that's the only thing they're going to understand? I mean, how do you apply this?
I would not use the word church to express anything that I believe. I mean, certainly the word church exists, and it has a meaning. But I use the word, as you can see here today. I mean, I don't just, you know, say, I don't have anyone beeping when I'm about to say church or anything like that. But I use the word church to convey... I use the word church to convey... Okay. I try to use the word church just to convey the meaning of the word church, not to convey the meaning of Kahal or anything else in the scriptures.
A minute ago you said that in the verse where Yeshua said, I will build my kahal on this rock, you said that you thought that was, he was referring to the Jewish people?
I didn't say that. What I did say, though, is that in all of these verses where kahal appears, now I don't think I said that. You can check the tape later to see if I did. But what I think I said is that in all these places that kahal appears in the Messianic writings, it's silly to think that it's something new, or where ekklesia appears.
Right.
It's silly to think that it's something new when we've been told in hundreds of verses about God's kahal.
Right.
So again, linguistically, it's not something new. Whether in this verse or that verse something new is being described is then a matter of interpretation. But you have to get the language right before you can go to the process of interpretation. You have to have a text to interpret. And if we have a false text, like the text in Hebrews, which made false statements and which completely misinterpreted the idea of a covenant and a testament and completely misinterpreted what was being said so that it became nonsensical as well as false, if we have a text like that, we're not going to get anywhere no matter how brilliant our interpretation is. So let's first try to figure out what the text actually is. Does that answer your question? Okay.
Yeah.
So you can check to see if see if you caught me or not. All right. One other example. Okay, go ahead.
This was... Because I think I understand what you were asking, Leslie, and I think it's not so much about what you choose to use, but in terms of application, in terms of explaining our understanding of the scripture, if we're approaching someone who has a distinct system that they've grown up with, like if they have grown up hearing church and that's their understanding of what the scriptures talks about, would you... try and use the words kind of like how the Jewish Greek scholars, what they took a Greek word and adapted it to have Hebraic symbolization, would you take the words that they know and kind of show, meet them in their context and then kind of show to bring them back to what it actually is supposed to be?
Well, I think it could be a strategy of discussion to use words and to question about the meaning of the words and to try to get back to what's actually described in the text, in Tanakh and in the Messianic writings. I would not use the word church in the way that you suggest, though, with as almost a type of Jewish Greek word or Jewish English word to try to relate to people. And the reason is that it's not suitable for that because it already has a meaning that contradicts the meaning that we would try to give it. Mm-hmm. So what was the reason that Christos could be used as an equivalent for Mashiach? It had no such connotation similar to the connotation of today. If it had the meaning it had today, or if it had referred to some Greek god or something like that, it could not have been used as an equivalent for Mashiach. The only reason that it could be used is because it had a simple physical meaning that corresponded to the basic physical meaning of the Hebrew word Mashiach, and it didn't have all these other connotations. So that's not the case with the English word church. The English word church has all sorts of connotations which are completely different
so
from what's intended by the text.
So we would have to adapt an entirely new word that doesn't have all that heavy connotation with it in order to kind of bring them back.
I would say so, yes. And of course, even the new word wouldn't be perfect. Just as covenant is not a perfect translation of the Hebrew brit, so too congregation is not a perfect translation of kahal. But it's better than church, because it doesn't have all those other connotations and denotations. Mm-hmm. Now, one other example that was given was on page 63. And this starts to get towards the issue of interpretation that many people have raised, knowingly or unknowingly, not because we're trying to actually determine an interpretation here, but just because it illustrates some of the implications for interpretation and why Christian interpretation is faulty in certain areas or can't really get at the true meaning of what's being stated simply because of the linguistic reality. So I'm talking about the example of how to treat certain people who persist in sinning. And someone help me out. I'm not seeing the exact place where it's quoted, but it's discussed on 63. Okay, yes. All right. So I'll start on the bottom of page 62. Yeshua spoke to his disciples about the sequence of steps to take with an offending brother. First, speak privately to the one who has sinned against you. If he is not responsive to that, then take two or three other believers and speak to him. If he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the ecclesia. And if he refuses to listen even to the ecclesia, treat him as you would a Gentile or a tax collector. How should ecclesia be translated in this verse?
Assembly. Community.
Let's say assembly, community, congregation, something like that. Something that reminds us of Kahal. How is it translated in our translations?
Church,
of course, church. So, let's try to put this advice into practice. Tell it to the church, and if he refuses to listen even to the church, treat him as you would a Gentile or a tax collector. How does the church treat a Gentile? They're all Gentiles. What are you talking about? It makes no sense. What about a tax collector? How does the church treat a tax collector?
Well, the Catholic Church treated them fantastically.
Right. That's part of what's described. Exactly. Fantastically. They were part of the church. They were used to oppress the people and to enrich the church and the state, which worked hand in hand. So this statement doesn't make any sense if ecclesia is translated as church. It doesn't give us any advice that can actually be followed. Or if it does, then it's a very strange kind of advice that we're given. Because certainly for the church to treat someone as a Gentile is either meaningless or it has a positive meaning, as you've described. Whereas the meaning here is not, it doesn't seem to correspond to the context. Now, by the way, even if we have an appropriate understanding of ecclesia, I think this verse is still often misinterpreted by people. How should members of the community of God treat a Gentile or a tax collector?
With love.
Yes, I think there's an aspect of both of these. As an outsider, with love. Mm-hmm. In other words, not recognizing them as a believer, but it doesn't mean you hate them, or you treat them badly, or you try to bring about harm in their life. Oh. Certainly. That would contradict instructions that we've already been given. So this verse can be misinterpreted on many levels, but certainly if you think of it as church, it's basically meaningless to treat someone as a Gentile or a tax collector. And that's one example, again, of why it's important to get the text right. And of course, we could go on and on with many examples.
The issue there that makes it more confusing isn't necessarily that ecclesia means assembly, but it's considered to mean a assembly of Gentiles.
Right. That's
as opposed to a Jewish kahal.
Right. Certainly, the meaning of the word church is not a Jewish assembly in any language. That's for sure. Whereas the meaning of God's kahal is just as certainly Jewish. Does anyone disagree with that? So we have polar opposites, just as we found in other cases that we've looked at. And that's why I started out with the quotations at the beginning, saying that you have two different worlds, completely different worlds. Nachamu ami yomar Eloheichem. Comfort my people, says your God. That's one word. One world. Another world is extra ecclesiam nulla salis. Outside the church, there is no salvation. These two worlds are not compatible. Yep.
Oh, I was wondering if the word Gentile is always translated as Gentile, or if it was translated as pagan.
Because how did a Gentile believer in those days, you know, there's no reading this for the first time, the hearing this, and the saying, you know, and the whole question, are we Gentiles, are we Jews now? Mm-hmm. And that whole thing.
Right. Well, yeah, it's a good question. The Hebrew word is goyim, which means nations, peoples, and the equivalent Greek term in Jewish Greek is ethne. The singular is ethnos. It means, it's where we get our word ethnic group, ethnicity. So it means approximately the same thing. And in most translations, these terms are not translated consistently. They are sometimes translated as Gentiles, sometimes translated as pagans, sometimes translated as heathens. Whether it's the translation from Hebrew or from Jewish Greek. So that's the answer. They're not translated consistently. But usually in any version of the Bible that you would read today, when you see Gentiles, heathen, pagans, it would all be referring back to, or supposed to refer back to, goyim and ethne. Other comments?
Well, from Jewish point of view, that's very consistent because the Jews divided the world into two camps, the Jews and the non-Jews, so everybody was either Gentile, pagan, whatever you want to call it. But in Jewish mindset, it just meant no Jew here.
Yeah, thank you. And by the way, that explains the verse. From a Jewish mindset, the verse makes perfect sense, because Israel was separate from the Goyim. So there was this understanding of separateness, and there was also an understanding of God's instructions about how to treat the Goyim. For example, if one's living with you, let there be one law for you and for him. Don't mistreat him. You know what it's like to be an alien in a strange land. So there's already an understanding of that. And by the way, that's not just the Jewish mindset. That's the biblical mindset. It's the divine mindset, if you will. God commanded these things. God commanded the separation of Israel from the Goyim, and God commanded about the treatment of Israel and the Goyim, both the separation and the kindness. So if you do remove that Christian understanding of just one word, and you instead substitute the biblical understanding, then the verse does make sense and can be understood and can be used as practical advice.
Genesis 12, where God talked to Abraham, and he says, I'll make you a great nation. He's making him a goy, a singular goy. So they use the same word, it's just a nation.
Right. Occasionally the word goy is used to refer in Tanakh to Israel. Not very often, but occasionally. But at the same time, you also have the statements that Israel will not be reckoned among the goyim. So Tanakh itself establishes that usage as separate, the usage of goyim as separate. So God says his people, in other words, though they are, of course, a people, a goy, they will not be reckoned among the goyim, among the peoples. They will be separate. And that has come to pass. The word, just if you look at the word goyim, it means Gentiles. And that's how it's often used in the scriptures. Well, we should move now to page 69, which deals with one of the more troubling passages in, I'll say, the New Testament, from a Jewish perspective. And, of course, now we're talking about interpretation and understanding based on our clarification of what words actually mean. So Revelation 2:9. Maybe if someone has a Bible, they could just look at their version of the Bible and tell us what it says for that verse. Okay.
I know your works, tribulation and poverty, but you are rich. And I know the blasphemy of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan.
A synagogue of Satan. Something that has been used, a phrase that has been used for centuries to justify horrible atrocities against the Jewish people. And this verse was taken to symbolize all of Israel, that the Jewish people are a synagogue of Satan. And the effects of that interpretation persist to this day, of course, and include the fact that probably a billion people on earth, if not more, are still extremely under the influence of ideology that states that the Jews are devils and from Satan. And that arose from Christian translation of this verse, of course, combined with Christian translation of other passages and the choices at the Council of Nicaea and so forth.
It's now, interesting, sorry, excuse me, it's interesting because in 65, there's an example of synagogue in James.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not read it actually in my Bible, but is it, I mean, I'm guessing it obviously is not saying, suppose a man comes into your synagogue. It's not the English translation, is it?
Right, exactly. We skipped that. Thank you. We actually should have dealt with that before going to the passage in Revelation. But when we have, very briefly, when we have the word synagogue in the Messianic writings, which, remember, is a pair for what Hebrew word?
Eda.
Again, an assembly, a community. The general translation in New Testaments, and you understand when I say New Testament, I'm talking about the Christian New Testament translations. I'm not talking about the original text. The traditional translation, when it refers to Jews, is synagogue, which is an inaccurate translation because it didn't mean synagogue at that time. It just meant an assembly. So you had the part of the chapter that talked about how it would be redundant to keep saying synagogue of the Jews if synagogue meant synagogue. It didn't. It meant a place where people are led together. And it could be any kind of people. But it's translated as synagogue, which is just a transliteration, of course, from the Greek. Now, when it refers to Jewish people, it's maybe not a terrible translation, even if it's inaccurate, because we understand that when Jews come together in those types of settings, it is what we understand now as to be a synagogue, although in some cases it might not have been a synagogue. However, the same thing takes place with translations of synagogue as takes place with translations of ecclesia. So ecclesia in a supposedly Christian context is translated as church, but when it is in the context of the Ephesians, it's translated as assembly. That's an inconsistent choice. The same thing takes place with synagogue. When it's in a supposedly Jewish setting, it's translated as synagogue. When it's in another setting, such as a supposedly Christian setting, a setting, of course, that didn't exist, but which is posited to have existed, it's translated differently. It's not translated as synagogue. So, Jacob 2:2. Suppose a man comes into your synagogue wearing a gold ring and fine clothes, and a poor man in shabby clothes also comes in. And then Yaakov goes on to describe how we should treat these people. And he says, if you show favoritism, are you really doing what's right? Now, I think regardless of how you translate synagogue, the principle is just as evident as it is ignored. But nonetheless, it's important for us to look at what the word actually means here. So if the translators actually thought that synagogue meant synagogue, then they would translate it as synagogue here as well. In the majority of cases, they translate it as synagogue here. Why do they choose to translate it differently?
It's not Satan.
No, here it's not. Here it's talking about believers in the Messiah. What's that?
James is writing to the Jewish people at that time went to the synagogue to worship, so it was appropriate to use it.
It would be appropriate to use it if it didn't say something contradictory to the Christian mindset, which is that believers would not be in a synagogue. Believers would be in a church. So that's why it's not translated as synagogue. I mean, here's a case where at least they could have been consistent here, because he's writing to Jews. So if we're going to use synagogue as synagogue of the, you know, in all the cases where it says synagogue of the Jews, you're going to say synagogue. Okay, fine. It's not exactly right, but we understand it. It's close. Here he could have used synagogue as well. But they don't for one very specific reason. It's talking to believers, so it couldn't possibly be a synagogue. But that has nothing to do with what the text is saying at all. And it's a, you have to see that it's a very conscious decision. There's no way that this can come about just through accident or ignorance. It's a conscious decision not to translate ecclesia as church in Acts, what is it, 19? And it's a conscious translation not to translate synagogue as synagogue in Jacob. Because if you translate synagogue as synagogue in Jacob, then synagogue has a positive meaning. And if you translate ecclesia as church in Acts, then church has a negative meaning. So again, remember the entire system of Christianity, not necessarily the content of the belief of every single Christian, but the system of Christianity as expressed consistently for centuries throughout history in various parts of the world by Christian theologians and writers. The basic fundamental principle is the opposition between old and new, Israel and the church. And in this case, obviously, the synagogue is associated with Israel, synagogue and church, if we want to, or Israel and Christians, I should say, and synagogue and the church. That's the basic principle of all Christian theology. And everything else is built on that structure. It's a structure that is not found in the Bible. And it directly contradicts not only what I believe to be the message of the Bible. Forget about that. I mean, you can think whatever you want to think about my interpretations. Maybe I'm crazy in my interpretations and none of what I think about the scriptures is actually accurate. Let's assume for the sake of argument that that's the case. It doesn't only contradict what I believe the scriptures say. It contradicts the actual language of the text. So let's just deal with the language of the text and the entire Christian system crumbles if we actually deal with the text itself. So thanks for pointing that out, because that's actually a necessary step to getting to the discussion of Revelation 2, which we'll do in a second.
So what Bible that's published anywhere in the world can one recommend? I'm sitting here thinking of, just because it's a better translation of the so-called original languages, like, say, the NASB, for example, I'm just thinking out loud, and this is not to disparage because I don't know the answer, but David Stern's written, you know, his version of the Bible, trying to keep the Hebraic reality of Scripture alive, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Does he have the correct usage also? Maybe
no.
You don't know. In other words, what Bible can you recommend? What do you read? You yourself.
Well, this question also arose in a previous class, in fact, almost in the same words. And very briefly, I mean, you can listen to the audio of the previous classes if you want, but very briefly, I don't think there is a version in English that conveys what we're talking about. There's a version that I would recommend in French. I don't think it's perfect, but it's very interesting, and that's the version by André Shirhaki. And the reason I would recommend it is because he actually translates from Jewish Greek as opposed to Christian Greek, which is what Christian translations do. And I'll say a bit more about that in a second. As for David Stern's translation, I do read it along with other translations and the original, and I find it very interesting. And by the way, in my personal opinion, the Russian translation of David Stern's translation is much better than the English versions. But as for the English version, it does not translate from Jewish Greek either. It does adapt the current Christian English translations to imbue them with some Jewish sense, but it is not a direct translation from Jewish Greek. And one of the evidences of this is that he uses, for example, Yiddish words. So he's introducing Yiddishkeit, which is maybe not a bad thing, but it's not the same thing as translating from the original. Now, with regard to the idea of translating from Christian Greek, I just want to make sure we are clear on this. The Christian translators actually make a double error in their translation. The first error is that they do not translate from Jewish Greek, which is the language of the text, as is clearly evident from the study, for example, of the Septuagint, which we've been going through. And we've only scratched the surface, but you could go on and on with all these different words. That's the first error. The second error is that they don't do what they claim to do either. They claim to translate from Koine Greek, common Greek, the common language of the Roman Empire, the Eastern Roman Empire. They don't do that either. Not at all. It wouldn't be as bad if they did that. What they do is they translate from some presumed Christian Greek, where ecclesia means church. Ecclesia did not mean church in the common language of the Eastern Roman Empire. If they translated just from Greek, it wouldn't be half as bad. So it's the second part of that error which is almost worse. Even if they were ignorant of Jewish Greek and just translated from Greek, it would be not exactly okay, but it would be a lot better.
What is the Koine definition? Do you know for ecclesia?
Well, yeah, it's in the chapter. Okay. It just means an assembly okay. of people. So and it could be, like, it's used, for example, in Greek city-states of the church, of the, not church, of the city council sometimes, oh, yeah. things like that. So that's the Koine meaning. So whether you translate from Jewish Greek or Koine Greek, you would come up with something like assembly or council or congregation or something like that. And you wouldn't have all of this Christian jargon. So what they do is they translate from an entirely fictional language, not only the wrong language, they might mistake the language and translate from a wrong language, like thinking that Yiddish is German, for example, and translating as if it's German. But not only do they do that, they translate from a fictional language, a Christian German. Well, that might not be a fictional language, but a Martian German, let's say. A Martian German. Yeah. Okay, one other comment or question, I think.
I'll say that.
Okay. So now I think we can actually go to that passage in Revelation, which is discussed from page 69 on, which translation did we read already?
NKJV.
New King James. I'm not sure which version this is, but it might be New American Standard because it looks a little bit different. I know your afflictions and your poverty, yet you are rich. I know the slander of those who say they are Jews and are not, but a synagogue of Satan. Well, that's a more literal version. Now, just to review, how is this passage interpreted in the Christian understanding? Who is being described here?
The Jews.
The Jews. Now, by the way, that interpretation does not make sense even with the Christian translations. Because the Christian translations themselves say, those who claim to be Jews, though they are not. So, is that really referring to Jews? It's a little confusing if you interpret it that way.
Right.
However, that is the way it's interpreted, and in much more damaging ways, as I described.
So replacement theology?
Yes.
Well, of course, it's under the influence in general of replacement theology, yeah. And if we wanted to say more broadly the Christian system, we could again compare that to the geocentric system mm-hmm. in Copernicus' day, which resulted in some very odd conclusions about the paths that the planetoi, the wanderers, would follow. And that's exactly what's going on here, some very odd conclusions about the planetoi, the Yehudim, the Jews, the wanderers. God's wonders. Now, as a result of this system and interpretation of verses such as this, we have incidents of the kind described on page 70. A traveling evangelical speaker says to the author, "So you're Jewish?" "Jewish, yes," I said. In a challenging tone, he replied, "I'm just as Jewish as you are." Mm-hmm. Now, probably many of us have actually encountered something like this. In talking to Christians, at the time I didn't know what he was talking about. He obviously wasn't Jewish. And again, I'll just relate this to the emperor's new clothes that we talked about. I don't know if it was last time or the time before, but I think it was last time with regard to the interpretation in Hebrews. I mean, it's only a child who says, but he's not wearing any clothes when everyone else sees the clothes. And here, it's only as a new believer that one can not understand what's being said. What do you mean you're as Jewish as I am? You're not Jewish. You know, it's kind of the thing a child would say. And again, this you may think this is my interpretation, and perhaps it is, but I think when we're told that we can't enter the kingdom of heaven except with the faith of a child, we might need to rethink that a little bit and determine what the faith of a child really is. And I was suggesting last time that the faith of a child is very honest. And this is very dishonest. Again, it's something that adults often don't recognize as dishonest because they're just so used to this and they've grown up with all of this tradition and all of this you know, structure of thought and so forth. But someone who's a neophyte might be able to recognize it. So what does someone mean when they say, when they're not Jewish and they say, I'm more Jewish than you, a Jew? To them, it makes perfect sense. But it doesn't really make any sense whatsoever.
It's like Ann Coulter's comment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we talked about that also. Yeah, that was a very good part of the discussion, I thought. So on page 71, just continuing in this discussion, the point is made that this verse is actually very similar to a verse in Tanakh and may even be alluding to that verse, quite possible. It is quite similar to the promise of the Mighty One of Jacob to Jerusalem. Quote, the sons of your oppressors will come bowing down before you. All who despise you will bow down at your feet and will call you the city of Adonai, Zion of the Holy One of Israel. Isaiah 60:14. Who's being spoken of here? Who is going to have these adversaries come and bow down before them? Jerusalem.
Yeah,
Jerusalem. Zion.
Yeah.
And symbolically, perhaps Israel, if you look at the rest of the context of the chapter.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the first verse that should pop into our mind when we read that verse in Revelation, because it's obviously related and it's obviously very similar. Now, does that help us understand the passage? Well, I think so. And that's the claim that's made on page 72. Listen again to what Yeshua said to his Jewish ambassador from Israel. It sounds different to Jewish ears than it does to traditional Christian ones. Quote, I will make those who are of the congregation of the adversary, Hasatan, who claim to be Jews though they are not, but are liars. I will make them come and fall down at your feet and acknowledge that I have loved you. Revelation 3:9. It sounds like the everlasting love of the God of Israel for his people Israel. After all, if God is speaking to a Jewish person and saying, talking about other people who claim to be Jews and are not, it's unlikely that by that he means the Jewish people. In fact, it sounds like a repetition of Isaiah 60, that all of those who have persecuted Israel through all of the millennia for being the people of God, for having his name, which he implanted on them, they will all have to come and bow down and acknowledge that they have been of the congregation of the adversary and not of the congregation of God, whereas God has loved Israel with an everlasting love. Now, of course, you noticed in that translation that synagogue was not rendered as synagogue as part of being consistent in saying that this word is simply a generic word for an assembly or a congregation of people. So the very phrase synagogue of Satan, which obviously has Jewish overtones because of the connotations, or now the denotation of synagogue, even that expression, that very phrase, is an inaccurate way of describing what's being expressed. Any questions or comments?
And the part about Christians who think that they're Jewish, they're usually referring to the passage about what a true Jew is, circumcision of the heart.
Yeah.
I don't know where that is, but...
Mm-hmm. Romans, too.
Yeah, I think it's Romans.
Mm-hmm.
So what's wrong with that? They're talking about being grafted in, so...
Well, that passage is actually discussed later in the book, so we will come to that in a future class. I think it's a similar case, not quite as extreme as this one, but it's a similar case of misunderstanding what's actually being said. And if you, again, take away the prism of Christian theology and Christian interpretation and substitute a biblical prism or biblical eyeglasses or maybe biblical 20/20 vision, I don't know what analogy you want to use, it's different. And of course, God spoke previously, just as in this case we saw something in Tanakh that God had already said that was the same. God spoke previously, I believe it's in Jeremiah or maybe Ezekiel, about, or maybe both, about circumcision of the heart and what it means. Mm-hmm. It's not something new and out of the blue where he's saying, well, the Jews are circumcised in flesh, but the Christians are circumcised in heart, so they're the real Jews. That's how it's generally interpreted, actually, but it's certainly not saying that at all. And I think, again, we'll probably discuss that a little bit more in a later class.
That's interesting, you know. My wife gave my father his first Passover meal since he was married. He married a Gentile. And my father said of my wife, who was Gentile, she has a circumcised heart.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting, the complete juxtaposition there.
Well, Gentiles are supposed to have circumcised hearts.
Yeah.
And that's how they can be brought into the Kahal of Israel.
Right.
Not as Jews, but as Gentiles.
Right.
And that's part of what is described as the mystery.
I think one thing that also makes the statement of a Gentile, a non-Jew, saying they're more Jewish than a Jew really absurd is that a lot of people are really ignorant that Jewishness is an ethnicity. I remember working over the summer and talking to one of my husband's former boss's kids. Mm-hmm. And he's a high school age kid, and in the course of the conversation I said that Jewishness is an ethnicity, and he was like, no, it's not, it's a religion. And a friend of mine in the group who usually was annoyed by how I was like super want to be knowledgeable about Jewishness even though I'm not Jewish was like, I hate to agree with her, but she's right, it is an ethnicity, because most people think of it only as a religion.
Right. Mm. Well, most people in the United States think of it as a religion. And that's partly related to the changes in Jewish culture that took place in the United States. But most people in other parts of the world think of it as a nationality.
Mm-hmm. The Bible defines it as a people, the chosen people.
Right.
The school of.
And by the way, you can't define the Jewish people by religion in any time period of history. Because, for example, if you look at Tanakh, in the time of King Ahab, what religion were most Jews following? Not the religion of the God of Israel. If he has a religion, I'm not convinced he does. But they weren't following in his ways. If you look at most Jews today in the world, what religion are they following?
Secularism,
humanism, certainly not biblical Judaism or any other kind of Judaism. Now, obviously, we're not denying that being part of the Jewish people has some implications in the realm of what we would call religion today in our compartmentalized modern world. Certainly it does. But a Jew is not really practically defined by religion in any place at any time in history. You can see this by the fact that people in the United States, even where this religious conception is primary, will talk about Jewish Buddhists and things like that. So who is a Jew can't be defined by what we call religion.
There's a certain jealousy or something about the term the chosen people, which, you know, the Christian religion wants to adopt, you know, as a chosen people. But it's a people. It's not the chosen religion.
It's a good point. And of course there's also a great misunderstanding about what it means to be chosen. There's a greater understanding of what it means to be the chosen people among the chosen people, where you can hear, of course, the lament over and over again, God, why don't you choose someone else once in a while? And it is a privilege to be chosen by God, but the scriptures make it clear that there's a very heavy weight of suffering that goes with being chosen by God. The scriptures also make it clear that God did not choose Israel because Israel was superior, but because Israel, as it's described, was in some ways inferior, so that his glory might be made manifest. And that's why there is suffering associated with Jewishness, and why there's suffering associated with being chosen by God, because it is not against the people, the Jews, that people are reacting. It's against God. It's against what God has placed in and on the Jewish people. And so the story of the Jewish people is the story of the relationship between Adam, humanity, and God. And most of humanity does not like God very much. And it's expressed in the way they treat the Jewish people. And that goes, of course, as... Baruch Hashem. I didn't make it up. You can read it. But this applies equally, of course, or if not more, to many people and groups of people who have claimed to follow the God of Israel. That's the saddest part about it. And especially those who have claimed to follow the Messiah of Israel. Well, any other questions or comments?
It was my thought, and I blush thinking it's going to be taped, but I was something that you mentioned where, and I'm probably going to misquote completely, but you said, with regard to the semantics anyway, that Christ would like destroy the church in terms of the words and that kind of thing. And I was, this is, no, you're misquoting me. Perhaps, but I was just, it harkened me back to the Muslims thing.
Right.
And maybe he will kind of, you know, break apart our misthinking.
Okay. I think that is true in that Messiah will lead us into all truth. The Spirit of God will lead us into all truth and so forth. I wouldn't want to take that... element of Muslim theology as evidence of it. what is actually stated in that description of Muslim theology of the Middle Ages is that they believed that Jesus would return, and of course, since Jesus is a Muslim, he would not agree with the distortions of the Jews and the Christians. So he would come and subjugate the Jews and Christians and destroy churches and synagogues and so forth. I don't think that's what our Messiah is going to do when he returns exactly. At least part of that is incorrect. But
all things will pass.
Right. I think maybe what you were referring to, I don't know exactly, but I think what you're referring to is when we were talking about how just looking at the linguistic concepts causes the structure of Christianity to crumble. Again, it's not talking about Christians per se or individuals, people's relationship with God or anything like that. It's talking about the philosophical or, as people call it now, theological structure of Christianity, which is set up in opposition not only to the message of the text, it is definitely in opposition many times to the message of the text, but it's also in opposition to the very words of the text. So if we just look at those words, a few little piddling words, that structure has to be replaced. It's similar, again, to what Copernicus did. That's the analogy that I think is holding throughout each of these chapters.
Well, the very description that modern theologians apply to their system of thought as it is applied to the scriptures speaks of that by the very fact that they have to define it as systematic theology, which implies by its very definition the application of a system of thought that comes from outside of the scriptures to understanding the scriptures.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they even recognize that to some extent.
They recognize it implicitly.
Yeah.
There is like a false categorization, which the Bible itself
does
not do.
Exactly, that's a much better way of putting
it. Right, right.
It's a much better way of putting
it. You mean in systematic theology, per se?
Yeah, the categorization. There is
right.
No such categorization.
Yeah, actually, I don't think there's any theology in the Bible, is there? I haven't noticed any, personally.
That comes with chapter 5.
Or religion, for that matter.
I thought maybe your father was doing a wordplay by saying systematic errors.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what it is? Or is it kind of a...
I think it's systemic. Okay.
He's always talking about the system rather than the categories.
Right.
But I thought maybe he was doing a wordplay with systematic.
Perhaps. I think obviously the systematic errors are meant to imply the systematic theology. I don't know if it was exactly a wordplay, but yeah, definitely.
It's kind of cute if it's true.
Certainly I think that's what he has in mind, that people would understand systematic theology and systematic errors, but it could be applicable to other realms as well. I mean, people in the United States talk about systemic or systematic racism, for example. Mm-hmm. And they mean something by that, which is different from individual racism. Mm-hmm. So in other words, what we're talking about, if we take that analogy, what we're saying is that we're not talking about individual anti-Semitism, let's say, or anti-Judaism, although it's very related, just as individual racism can be very related to what people mean by systematic or systemic racism. But we're actually talking about the system that raises people in that type of environment. So that's what's, again, being described for the geocentric Christian world, if you will.
I found this chapter very convincing as far as the central premise, which is that there's no church in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
But I think one of the reasons why people hold on to that so strongly is because of what church means. In other words, you get read this and say, okay, there's no church in the Bible, there's congregation, there's assemblies, community, but not a church. But then you have to get to the point of saying, okay, what is meant by congregation or community?
Mm-hmm.
What is, and that I think you alluded to before when you're talking about it's not just the general term for assembly, but who is, what is God's assembly? What is God's congregation? And that's, I think, why people want to hold on to church.
Okay.
And that's the way they're saying it.
Right. I think that people want to hold on to the church because of many reasons. One of which would be what they associate with it if they're inside. Another would be just tradition and the fact that how could all of these millions of people who have the truth be wrong? The church is associated with truth. As we read, you know, here's, excuse me, Martin Luther's quote. Outside of the Christian church, there is no truth, no Christ, no salvation. I humbly beg to differ. But most Christians would not differ with that statement. Even today. Some would, maybe, but most would not. Certainly the Christian system doesn't differ with that. I think there are other reasons as well that people don't want to abandon it. But you raise a good point that if we do abandon that notion, or any of these other notions that are described, Old Testament, New Testament, church, for some people who are familiar with those concepts and to identify those concepts with their faith, it's a little shocking, and they don't understand, well, what comes next? Again, I want to suggest that we can only understand not only what comes next, but what is really there by looking at the text as it is written. So we have to proceed logically in that sense. We have to first try to understand what the text actually says, then we can try to understand what it means, and we'll be in a much better situation. And I think that some of the meanings we get out of it will be surprising, others won't be. I think the meanings will be surprising only in that they are so familiar. When I went to Israel, the thing that was most surprising to me was that it felt so normal. It didn't feel different or strange. And I think that's the kind of surprise that we'll get, or at least a Jewish person would get, from the message in the way that God conveys it. Because God calls his message good news, which is another interesting point or issue in translation. It's translated in English as gospel, oftentimes from the Jewish Greek evangelion, you know, a good report, good tidings. This is not a word that was invented in the New Testament. It's a word that we have, for example, here in Isaiah 40, where God calls Zion a proclaimer of good news, calls Yerushalayim a proclaimer of good news. He says that they are to say to the cities of Judah, behold your God, the God of Israel. So the message that God is presenting in the good news is also not new in that sense. Linguistically, it's not new. God's told us about the good news frequently in Tanakh. And it's good news for Israel. That's the context in which it appears. How many of you have had experiences in which the Christian gospel does not appear to be good news to Jewish people? If you haven't, you haven't really presented the Christian gospel to Jewish people. Because it's not good news for Jewish people most of the time. some people are able to penetrate through many of the errors that surround it and to find the kernel of truth. You know, Baruch Hashem, and to find that kernel of truth and come to know the Messiah despite a Christian presentation. But the Christian gospel is not very good news for the Jewish people. God's gospel, God's good news is. So there has to be a fundamental change in what we think we're communicating, or rather, again, what we think God is communicating. We should try to discover what God is communicating. And one could choose many different passages, of course. I chose the passage about comforting my people, says your God. It's in a part of Tanakh where it cannot be interpreted as meaning anything but Israel, when God talks about his people. So it's not talking about the church, it's not talking about Christians. God's referring to Israel as his people, and he didn't change his mind about that. But that is really only one of many passages. It's one tiny portion of all of Tanakh, which says the same thing, which we should therefore be reminded of when we think of the good news. And we should look forward expectantly to the time when we will have an understanding of the good news, such that when we present it, it actually is good news for Jewish people.
You know, I find it interesting in the prophetic prophetic passages of the Bible, Christians will take things like comfort my people, and say, oh, the Lord's comforting me. Mm-hmm. And then they'll take texts like, prepare to meet your God. So, you know, it's not me.
Right.
It must be the Jews.
Right. Or you'll be cursed in the city and you'll be cursed in the country. That one doesn't refer to the church as much. That one refers to Israel.
I'm sorry. Whoever's blocking Kyra Inch needs to go, so if you could move your vehicle.
Okay.
What is it, Kyra?
Kyra.
Well, we're about to close also, so I'll just say that we should be grateful to God for bringing us into his community and opening our eyes, and may he continue to give us humility and wisdom and understanding as we seek to know his word. B'Shem Yeshua. Amen.